Torah. We're just about to start today. We're commencing with chapter 3 in Ecclesiastes and Qoheles, and we'll start just about in a minute. JHF, thanks for the audio confirmation. Starting just one moment, which for our friends to call in. And again, we're starting from starting a new chapter today, chapter 3 in Qoheles. And again, we put the classes online under the audio link, so you can hear all the previous classes up to this point. And Laura, thanks for the audio confirmation. Received the what we were talking about last week was your question about, since the Torah says that you're not allowed to mention the names of other gods, so were we allowed to mention Jesus? So Rabbi Chait said that he is not a god, he's a human being, so it is not a problem. So the question is, what does he mean by that? Because so then I'll say, you know, a pillar of stone that that people make into a god is, that's just a rock. So just like you're telling me with Jesus is a human being, so maybe I'll say that a pillar of stone is, you know, that's just a rock. So what have I gained? What is, it was by email. I got the response by email, so I wasn't in the conversation with them to ask him. So we can think about that for a moment, and then we'll start chapter 3 in Qoheles.
So he didn't give an explanation for that. He just said that you can say it because he's a man, not a god.
Right. He's a human being, not a god. That was the answer. And then
so people put up a pillar of stone and they worshiped it. When they put up a pillar of stone or some object and they worship it, do they think it's a god or do they think it represents a god?
It could be either.
Okay.
Then what is a cross similar?
Can you say that again?
I'm sorry, wouldn't a cross be similar? An item of wood meant to symbolize there?
Well, I don't think people, unless I'm wrong, people don't look at the cross as a god. It's a symbol, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that wouldn't apply. If you're not talking, just put your mute button on. It's just like a little background noise.
Squirrels in the phone line.
Yeah. Very small ones, I guess.
Yeah.
But I was thinking that, yeah, well, think about it. Think about it a little longer. I have a thought. Ideas?
Well, the only thing that's coming to mind, I mean, people think if you take the case of a pillar of stone, okay, they think the pillar of, you could say, well, you can say the name of the pillar of stone because it's a rock, not a god. So then it would seem like that Rabbi Chaya is making a distinction between a human being and an inanimate object.
Good stuff. Although he didn't say, all he said was that he's not a god, he's a human being. So it could be even other animate objects, but not man. Meaning man precludes it for some reason from falling in the category, whereas everything else could be considered a god, and then the prohibition of mentioning the name would apply. So we have to look for something that's exclusive to man, that would exclude him from ever being a god, whereas anything else, those objects could fall into the category of alien gods, and then we would not be allowed to say their name, unless, of course, like we learned last week, that the Torah mentions the name of those gods, to bring them out, to ridicule them. But without the
Torah. Rabbi, I mean, say somebody worshipped the sun, we could still use the word sun to refer to the big,
Well, that's not a name of a god. Like, Apollo would be perhaps the issue here.
Which brings up a side point, but I'd like to address at some time, that some other stuff that came out on the in the discussion on the web news group around this was, what about all the names of old gods that permeate, things that we do, like the Apollo astronauts. Somebody mentioned that the word January has pagan roots. Someone said that the Hebrew calendar month Tammuz has a pagan root to it. I thought about the Ford Taurus. I thought, well, how far do you take this, and where do you draw the line, especially when those words don't mean today what they meant, years ago?
Right. Meaning that if we have the same name today, but we're not using it to refer to a god, is that a problem?
Yeah, like if January was once a god, then are we prohibited from saying the month of January?
Right.
Another good example is like all the days of the week. Sunday, Moon Day, Tuesday, Odin's Day, Thor's Day, etc. Are those all all pagan names?
Those are all names of gods, yeah.
It's Friday, Saturn Day. It's everywhere, it's everywhere.
I mean, those were the days that they, you know, worshiped different gods, apparently.
And without some discerning difference, I think there are some who would take that commandment in the Torah and say, well, then I'm not allowed to say any of those things. And it's hard for me to imagine that that is what God intended. Because I don't know how a person could function today. And I'm not aware of any Torah scholar or Torah authority that, you know, even suggests that.
Right. Well, let's see if we can address the initial question that we had regarding why man, if they deified him, would not be a problem to refer to his name like Jesus. Like Rabbi Chait said, that's the person. He's a human being. He's not a god. Okay. So how does that answer a question for us?
Rabbi, would the distinction be that we would treat that category, human beings, separate because we are human beings?
No. I don't see that, how that plays a role. Well, the issue over here is what can be considered a god and what can't be. And Rabbi Chait is saying that man cannot be because he's a human being.
A thing cannot make itself? So how could a human being be God because a human being is very obviously created and has a beginning and an end?
So do animals. So does everything.
Well, the unique difference of man is that he can think cognitively about his own existence.
There's a lot of unique characteristics of man. Man can talk. Man wears clothes. You're not connecting it with the issue.
Right. No, I'm trying to find one that somehow fits that connection.
Rabbi, could the distinction have something to do with the idol being made by man?
I don't understand. What do you mean?
Well, I'm looking at when you make something out of stone or, you know, whatever that you worship, it's made by man.
Well, what about an animal? That wouldn't apply to animal.
You worship animal. Hmm. Okay.
Sorry. See, one thing you could say like this, one approach, is that a god would be something which is external to man. Meaning, since idolatry is man's attempt to seek assistance. The assistance is external to himself. That's a foundation of idolatry. So therefore, it would have to be anything which is external to man that can be considered an idol. Since it's man's search or man's projection. The act of projecting a power onto something means it's something outside of me, something outside of my species. But man itself, you would not say that that's idolatry. Rabbi Chaita is saying that, well, you can say Jesus' name because he's a man, not a god. Meaning also that he is a, we recognize the this reality. It's something which is opposite, perhaps. He's the one that's seeking the god. So he's a man, he's not god. Oh, but a rock or an animal, so those are external to him. So those are things that he could imagine and project power onto. You see the point?
Yes, except that people do in fact project power onto to Jesus.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. But I guess it would not be considered idolatry. Be some other problem. Is that static? It doesn't sound like static, that noise.
No, but I wonder if it's some kind of line interference. Hmm. Does everyone have their phone on mute?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, that's got to be something in the line.
Something in the line. So that was really...
I don't hear anything.
You're not hearing anything?
Now I am.
Okay.
Now I am.
Yeah. All right, we'll have to live with it. It's all right.
Okay.
All right, let's think about the question. And let's start chapter 3 of Kohelis, all right? Not going to be a long class today, primarily because I still have unanswered questions, but I think we can make some inroads into what's going on. So, Doug, why don't you take it away and let's read, and I'm going to base where we're going to stop on Ibn Ezra, because he says that all the verses up to 16 are connected. He says they're all connected. So read 1 through 15, starting with the beginning of chapter 3, okay?
Okay, so my translation has, everything has an appointed season, and there is a time for every matter under the heaven, a time to give birth and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to uproot that which is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break and a time to build. A time to weep and a time to laugh, a time of wailing and a time of dancing, a time to cast stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to rend and a time to sow, a time to be silent and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, time for war and a time for peace. What profit has the one who works in that which he toils? I have seen the occupation that God gave to the sons of men and with which to occupy themselves. He has made everything beautiful in its time, also the wisdom of the world he put into their hearts, save that man should not find the deed which God did from beginning to end. I knew that there is nothing better for them but to rejoice and to do good during his lifetime. And also, every man who eats and drinks and enjoys what is good in all his toil, it is a gift of God. I knew that everything that God made, that will be forever. We cannot add to it, nor can we subtract from it. And God made it so that they fear him. That which was is already done, and that which is destined to be already was, and God seeks the pursued.
Okay. All right. So let's start. Again, there's no shortage of enigmas in the way he presents the matters here. All of a sudden, he starts chapter 3 and he starts giving us a series of 28 different opposites. And he subsumes them under his initial heading of "There is a time." To everything. It sounds like there's a mute button. Somebody has a mute button? You should press it. We could hear the ringing. Okay, so to everything there is a time and an era. This is the time of an ace. How do you translate ace? Maybe a season. Anything which is desired under the heavens. And then he gives examples. So the first question is, what is he addressing? Again, whenever you have a statement, it's to address something which we would think otherwise. That's what we call in Hebrew a chiddush, or a new insight. So the insight is which corrects a previous notion that we have, which is wrong, or a false assumption. Therefore, we're told something. A person might think that taking somebody else's property is permissible, because morality is not something which is an objective truth, like, for example, knowing the difference between a square and a circle that a person can see, but he knows there's a truth to that. But morality is an issue not of true and false, it's an issue of whether something is right or wrong, and that's only something which can be determined by the Creator. Without God telling you that stealing is wrong, what would make it incorrect? It may be inconvenient because it would promote something which, you know, some sort of a status quo in society where somebody could steal from you and you wouldn't like that. That's merely an inconvenience. That does not mean it's wrong. So a person has to be told in the Torah that stealing is something which you cannot do. It is wrong. And that's why there's such a, there's such a conflict that never end between pro-life and pro-abortion. They can't make up their minds because there is no way to determine whether you can do it or not. It's not something which is observable in the universe. That is an authoritative source has to tell us that. That's God. Morality. All has to come from God. That's why there's going to be constant conflicts. But you don't see the world, conflicting on addition or mathematics. Everybody sees this, empirical evidence. So number one, he's telling us here that there's a time for everything. Why do I need to know that? What is he addressing there? Number one. And he goes through all 28. We're not going to go into them, at least at this moment. After he concludes, so that's at the end of verse 8. Then he asks a question. Or he makes an astounding statement. He says, what benefit is there for the one who performs all that he toils? Where is that coming in from? Then verse 10. Alright, so that's two questions. Verse 10 says that the King Solomon says, I've seen the matter which God has given to the sons of man. La'anos means to afflict. You're allowed to try him. And affliction is not necessarily bad. So keep that in mind. Yom Kippur is considered a day of affliction. But it's for good. So we have to understand what he means by that. That he's seen the matter which God has given to the sons of man to afflict him. To try him. Yeah, he talks about the Targum explains it. And he sees the Yisurin, the afflictions and the punishments that God has given to men that are wicked. Okay, we may take a different explanation on that. 11, I guess that's three questions. Number 11 now says, all is made proper and it's time. Also, the world is placed in his heart that he should not see the end of the matter. And the commentaries say that he shouldn't see, which God did from beginning to end, which means that he should not see the day of his death. Okay, well, what is he bringing that in for? Okay, this is a number of questions. Let's start with the first. What is he doing by saying there's a time for this and a time for that?
Rabbi, I remember, and I can't recall if it's in Ecclesiastes or Proverbs, but that he makes the comment somewhere that you shouldn't say, like, the former days were better than these days. As people sometimes say, you know, things were better in the good old days. Is he trying to get across the idea that you shouldn't compare and you should accept what is happening in the time that you're in because there isn't a better time, there's just what's going on right now?
Well, I wouldn't say that there isn't a better time. Why is that not true? I'm sure there are plenty of times in history that were worse. And then plenty of times that were, you know, conversely better. It's not a false statement. I mean, I'm sure you're not, you know, objecting to that. You're saying that despite that, a person should only be focused on his time?
Yeah, as opposed to sort of comparing it and being caught up in the comparison. Like, you know, there's a time for relaxation, but there's a time for work. And sometimes we might say, well, I'd just rather have a life of relaxation. But that's not the way that life happens.
Okay, so why does he have to tell that to us? We understand that. The person realizes... The person realizes that he cannot just be vacationing all the time. He has to work.
Is that so that we don't constantly pursue something that's impossible to get, which is like, I'm not sure it's immediately obvious to everybody that there is a time for love and a time for hate and a time for war and a time for peace. Everybody just wants the peace part without recognizing there does have to be some war sometime.
Okay. So if it's so obvious, what is his, King Solomon trying to get across to us that he feels that we don't know?
Well, what I'm saying is I don't think that's immediately obvious to people.
I agree with Doug. I think that King Solomon is letting us know that we don't have to worry. There's time for everything, and that life takes care of itself, I think, in a sense. Is that what you mean, Doug?
Well, I'm thinking of it more in terms of a striving point of view, where a person, rather than accepting the circumstances he finds himself in, will expend his energy wishing he were somewhere else.
Well, it's not talking about where or
right.
Time for him. It's, if you look at it, the times that, you know, King Solomon is describing here are, for example, let's see.
Anybody have a small child in their nearby?
Let's see here.
Rabbi, can I ask if everybody can bear with us, since we're bridging the call, can you hang up and let me dial back in? And bridge you in again in hopes. I wonder if we've accidentally picked up a cross line from some other place.
Should I, what should I do here?
You should hang up. Everybody else stay on the conference line, and we'll dial back into the conference line and then dial you back in again.
Okay, I'll hang up now.
I'll ring you back.
Okay, how's it now?
So far, so good.
Okay. So, see, what he's discussing is not the personal time frames in one's own life that he's comparing. You had good times in life, you had bad times, and now just live for now. That's not what he's saying. He's saying certain actions. Right? Meaning, you could, it's two different things. You have to see clearly here. He's not comparing a person's life and different points in the person's life. He's comparing different points of time, regardless of the individual, but saying that there's a time for planting or a time for to not to plant or to uproot. And he's not talking. He's not comparing segments of a human being's life. You see, he's comparing actions, and sometimes the action is good, sometimes it's not. Okay, so I just wanted to be clear, that's not what he's talking about. He's not talking about moments in our lives. Do you see that?
I do. Now, you just said he's not. He's saying some are good and some are not. Where do we get that?
What do you mean some are good and some are not?
Well, you just said, I thought, maybe I misunderstood, that you said that some of those times are good and some of those times are not. Did I misunderstand?
Right, sometimes you're appropriate, I should say. It's appropriate to plant and sometimes it's inappropriate to plant.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying.
Okay.
Have I?
Yes.
Could this be recognizing that all of these things are outside of a person in a sense that it is reality, and that reality exists whether man recognizes it or not? That if man tried to control it, like say he wanted to plant something, so he does it in the off time and he won't get any reward from that because he wasn't working with reality, the reality that is.
What does he mean by the fact that is a time for plant and there's a time to uproot that which is planted?
I think what it's saying here is that the true reality exists whether man recognizes it or not, and that if man doesn't recognize it and align himself with these things, then he will probably find himself frustrated or...
I don't disagree with your point, but I don't see that from the words. I don't see where he's talking about a person and aligning himself with reality. He's talking about certain activities or... right? I mean, he's talking about, again, there's a time for all different... a chayfis means like an objective, a purpose.
To me, it seems like if you synthesize all these things down, it's reality.
So when he's saying there's time for this reality and time for that reality, what is he telling us with this thing about there's a time? I mean, sometimes it's not a right time. I mean, like he says, a time for love and a time for hate, a time for war and a time for peace. Those seem to be things that a person will initiate. See, what he's saying is, I believe, is one concept. and that is that do not look at any event or desire and say it is always a good. That's the first step. He's trying to tell you, no, there's a time. Sometimes it's appropriate, sometimes it's not. Why does he have to tell us this? What's the notion that we have that he is correcting?
That we tend to put labels on things as being good or bad, and it's not, it just is.
Okay, good. Meaning to say that we tend to want to look at something as being always a good. We're looking for an absolute. This is good. This is bad. And that's it. No change of label, like you're saying. All right, so that's the first step. The first step is that he's trying to show that there, you know, sometimes dancing right and sometimes mourning is right. Meaning to say that a person will not think that way. A person will always want to seek peace and think that that is always the good always. No. Sometimes you have to wipe out a whole nation. That's what the commentaries say. Meaning to say, don't try to look for something which is absolutely good all the time, because it's not. There's too many factors. I mean, now we can explain now why that is. There's many factors. There's many people in the world. There's many events. There's nature. So, since there is change, since the world is subject to change, therefore we have to assess it and respond accordingly. But why does a person, why do human beings want to have something which they can say, oh, this is always a good? Where does that come from? That comes from a human being's insecurity. That a person is trying to find things that are getting, again, it's the ultimate search for happiness. That's what everybody is looking for. After all is said and done, every pursuit is about how am I going to achieve happiness? And that's what this whole sefer, this whole book, Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, it's what it's all about. People's assumptions as to where our happiness comes from. So now, step by step, King Solomon takes apart different elements and different assumptions that people have, psychological principles that people may just accept or they see, they misinterpret things, or they see the rest of the world functioning that way. Now what he's trying to tell you is a new point, that don't think that certain things are always going to be good or always going to be bad. Approach it in terms of, an intelligent person. And he goes through a series of things. A series of events and attitudes, right? Meaning like birth and death, those are events. That's not under man's control. Actions are like killing and healing. Okay? Attitudes are crying and laughter. So he talks about events, he talks about actions, he talks about attitudes. Right, the whole scope, the whole range of involvements of a human being, whether they're initiated externally by nature or by others, whether they're initially initiated by the self, feelings or wrong ideas. Okay, so that's the first idea. Do you hear the idea? We should not live with an idea that something is an absolute good, that's it. Because that's just looking for a way to make myself secure. Oh, I've got it. I've got the Holy Grail. I've got that thing which has that, it's going to offer that to me. No, the real happiness of a person is going to be, and this is what you touched on earlier, Cal, about a person who aligns himself to reality. He's constantly gauging what's going on, and if something shifts, so then he shifts with it. He's not static. He has to observe, he has to realize what the right response is, and use intelligence. Look at how the world is operating, work within the change that exists. The reason why these things can't be good all the time is because the world is constantly in change, to say it, you know, simply. Okay. And there's also the fact that people tend not to change themselves, which compounds this problem. People, you hear so many times, you can't change a person. Well, life is supposed to be about a constant change, where you're improving yourself at every moment. At every turn, the person should be looking and making change. A friend of mine told me once, he was quoting, I think, Rabbi Chaya, he says that the wise man is the person that can change. He recognizes how to respond. At one time in King David's life, he was being chased by a certain person and he was going to be found, so he acted like a retarded person, like a fool, and he drooled from his mouth. This is what King David did. In order that he should no way be viewed that he could possibly be a king. And that's exactly what the response was of when his enemy found him. And he saw him, he was like a drooling fool. And he did that, but he knew, King David knew, this is now what I have to do to save my life. I have to act in a way that there's no way my enemy can look at me and think that I am King David. Evidently, he never saw him face to face before. So he knew that was necessary. And when King Saul was chasing after David to kill him, he also changed his attitude. And he called King Saul his father, and he praised him greatly. And King David referred to himself, he says, "What am I? I'm a flea or a dog that you're chasing after. I'm nothing." And he bowed down to the ground to King Saul. He did all this because he recognized human psychology, that if a person's out to kill you and you show yourself to be completely subservient to him, like a meek nothing, so the person's going to lose all ambition to kill you because in his eyes, there's nothing to kill. You're a nothing. You're like scum of the earth. So there's no use in killing you. You are dead already. So he knew exactly what to do to disarm King Saul at that moment. But King David knew, and he said it, and it's brought down in the prophets, and he said to himself, even though King Saul said he's not going to chase after me anymore, I know he will. So King David knew it was just a momentary way to save him, to save himself. Okay, so that's a good example of how, two cases King David had to change in order to work with what was necessary for his life. All right, so it's an important point you're saying. Don't ever think and don't look at something, this is it. That's what most people do. They're looking for, if I have this, or if I can be this type of person, I have that position, or if I can go there, whatever it is, they say, this is now what's going to give me the happiness. No, happiness comes when you can work within reality and you see what's necessary to be done. If you try to have peace with people all the time and try to love all the time, you may love an enemy and he'll kill you because you have put your guard down. Okay. What's the next thing he says in verse 9 after he gives all these examples? Any questions, by the way? Any questions or comments? Okay. Is everybody still there?
Yes.
Okay. Now there's no static at all. I can't tell if the line is working. Okay. We should get a line that has a slight static. That's what we should really get. Alrighty. Now in verse 9 he says as follows. He says, what benefit is there to the one who does, to the worker, in the labors that he does? So now what is he saying? He's now addressing. What is he addressing?
Could he be addressing that it's all temporary and that we need to just recognize that reality?
Well, that he addressed with telling you that there's a time for everything. He now doesn't bring time into the picture in this verse. He says, my Yisram, what benefit is there to of the one who labors, in that he toils. Meaning, in his pursuit of these things, see, he's looking for the benefit. So this is, I think this is complementary to the, you know, what he just said. And that a person will typically go after things, the sense of accomplishment. And he's trying to, he has a certain idea of what is going to give him happy, so he feels, I will accomplish this. So that is the expression of what King Solomon was addressing up to this point. He was saying up to this point, everything has a time where it's proper and a time where it's not. So don't be the person in verse 9 that is going after something he has a certain idea of accomplishment in his head. What benefit is there to the one who labors in his labor? Let's see. According to Rashi, he says, what is the benefit to the one who does evil and all of his labor? His time will come, and then everything will be lost. That's one explanation.
So he's interpreting the toil in verse 9 to be evil?
That's Rashi.
Interesting.
It could just be an example.
Rabbi, why is he saying that? Do you have an idea?
No, I'm not really clear on Rashi's point. I mean, Sforno has a different opinion. He says that now, due to the fact that everything is in flux, right up these first 8 verses are talking about a time for this, a time for that. Nothing is really fixed that it's the proper thing to do. So then, according to Sforno, he has a good question. He says, this will now create a doubt on the Creator, that he intends that a person should reach, you know, perfection in life, perfection of man. How will he do this? Because things are in flux. He says, "Vezeh yulad sofek alabore." This will give birth to a doubt on the Creator that intends that man reaches a certain perfection, a certain completion. How will he need to work and to be diligent in his temporary time here?
Rabbi, can we answer the question in 9 without going on and pulling in 10 through about 13, or maybe through the rest of the section?
Good. You have an answer?
Well, it seems like he's kind of addressing it. It's cryptic for sure, but he's going on in 10 and saying, "I've seen the occupation that God gave to the sons of men with which to occupy themselves," which seems like he's starting to somehow give an answer to what's the point of all this work you do. And it almost seems like it comes down to 13, where he said, "Every man who eats and drinks and enjoys what is good in all his toil, it is a gift of God." In other words, you know, there's nothing magic about it long term, like making monuments or things that will last forever and ever, but it's, you know, you should do your job and eat food and drink and enjoy the world, and to be able to do that and accept that, that's a gift.
So what is he saying in 9? You said you want to answer it.
It seems like he's saying the profit that one has who works in that which he toils is to be able to eat and drink and enjoy the fruits of his labor.
That's much later. 9 is just saying a question. What benefit is there in the laborer in all the work that he does? What is he saying?
Right, and then isn't he answering that in 10 through 13?
Well, what's his question? We have to understand the question before we understand the answer. Ibn Ezra says, similar to Rashi, but more generally says, after all things are dependent upon time. Now that I stated this, and nothing is really good permanently, it has its moments, if that's true. So what benefit is there to man with all of his labor? Because since it's proper that a time will come, and he'll and his work will be destroyed, and he'll lose his profit, and he'll end up being completely impoverished. Meaning things change. So if things are such in flux, now what he's saying is similar to what Sforno says. So now, I mean, how am I going to reach a a complete type of life when nothing is really fixed? There's time for war, there's time for aid. I mean, there's a time for to have money, and there's a time to lose the money too then. He said everything has a time. He didn't list everything because you can't list everything. Everything is a very, very, long book. So right here, he just gives a glimpse of about 28 things. But since everything is now going to be in flux, so and there's really no control, these things happen, there are uncontrollable, variables. So now, why should the person then, he's now asking the question, he's verbalizing a person's question. Going to Ibn Ezra. So this now pulls out the carpet from underneath the person, and that was his intent. His intent was to pull the carpet out. Don't try to look at things and say that's where happiness comes from. So now, that means all the things I was looking for, meaning objects and events, things external to me, since everything now is in flux, now a person will have the correct attitude that King Solomon was trying to induce. Now it makes the person's whole foundation very, very, wobbly. So now the person will hopefully look for something else to supplant his false idea of where happiness comes from. He was looking externally and saying, if I have this, I have that, this will make me happy, that will make me happy. No, now King Solomon shows you no. Sometimes it's time for that, sometimes it's not. And then he says in verse 10, I said, I see the matter which God has given man to try him. That's a good thing. Meaning to say, now I see. And I see that this is something which is a problem for a person. Because typically a person does want to look at certain things and say, ah, this is a good, and let me go after that in life. But the wise person will recognize what King Solomon's lesson is. No, there's no absolutes. And he has to train himself away from that. That's what verse 10 is. He's saying, I see the matter which God, and he uses the word of the reference of God as being God of justice. Different names of gods have different connotations according to the rabbis. Here he uses the God of justice. I mean, he's doing something which is like a judgment for man. It's a good thing for man that he goes through this, and he has to abandon false beliefs, which is uncomfortable for a person. But it's a good, because now he's training him towards the right life. At 11, he says, what? Everything I saw is good in its time. Meaning to say that he's complimenting the plan now. Now that God has done this and he's made man shake his beliefs in certain things, and it's to try him, meaning to train him away from the wrong ideas of thinking that certain things are absolutely good all the time. No, he's training him away from that. But now he compliments God's plan and he says everything is good in its time. Meaning this whole thing that he discussed, this whole matter about there being a time for this and a time for that, that it is a good that things happen like that. But then he says also the world is planted in the man's heart that he should not see. Man should not find out the Maisa, the events, which God has done from beginning to end, meaning death. Because if a person, see that's also a good. We talked about a time to be born and time to die, right in the beginning. However, that's something which has its own time also. That should not be something which a person is in front of his eyes every day, his death. No, person's got 100 years, 110, 120, whatever the amount of time that a person has, it's out there and it's not present in front of his eyes, and there's a denial, meaning to say here that King Solomon is saying that even the denial of death is a good thing, because it allows a person to proceed in life. Because if he thought he's going to be worrying every single day, is today where I'm going? If a person thinks like that, he wouldn't do anything. He wouldn't move. He'd be too morbid, and he would have no sense of permanence, but he needs to have that. So that's also, there's a time for that. Later on in life, 100, 110, 120, a person, you know, takes care of themselves, they can live, you know, a long life. So a person shouldn't have that in front of them. So that's also the time for that. That's why I believe he also says the word also. If you look at verse 11, it says, everything is has been done and is good in its time. Also the world he has placed in man's heart. Meaning, what do you mean the world he has placed in man's heart? The feeling of being permanent in the world he has placed in man's heart. In order that he shouldn't recognize death as being something imminent. I mean, just as part of the plan, the things are good in their time. There's a time for a person to be worried about that. Now is not the time.
Rabbi, I'm not understanding what you mean by now's not the time. I mean, isn't a person supposed to keep in mind the fact that his life is finite and that...
That should be a recognition, but that shouldn't be something which is that he should be thinking today could be the day. That's not what God wants. The rabbi said, if you do that, the person won't be able to move. He won't build a house, he won't plant a vineyard, Rashi says. If he thinks that death is very close at hand. He's playing on the word. The world. The word world also could be hidden. So you can read it that all is good in its time, and even an enigma has God given in man's heart, meaning even a blindness, something God put something hidden in man's heart. He hid from man the day of death. Meaning to say that's necessary in order that he has the foundation on which to proceed in life. Just the question, we can see how it follows, because it's talking about time again. It's going back to the issue of time. But the truth is, I'm not fully satisfied with, because there's a lot in this verse, this past few verses. So maybe what we'll do is, we'll end here, review this more, because I feel there is more too than what we have mentioned, for sure. But I wanted to get a flow, you know, get into the chapter and just make some, you know, just a few points, just to give us some bearings. All right?
Okay.
Anybody else, any other questions or answers before we wrap it up today?
Thank you so much. Yeah, I had a quick question on something else. I had a quick question on whether you can, if God's name was written by an idol worshiper or something, or it's part of a avodah zarah, would you be able to burn it? Somebody told me you can do that, and I thought you would have to bury it.
Good question. I don't know. It's a good question.
I can't speak about burning, but I did ask the question when I had it. Was cleaning out my mother's house. She had a whole bunch of Christian literature, including Bibles, left over. And I asked Rabbi Tate the question of whether we could shred those and recycle them, as opposed to trying to bury all that stuff. And he indicated that I could.
Uh-huh. So that would answer your question.
Yeah, because I think the idea was that their idea, when they write God, it's not like the right idea.
Mm.
That's the understanding that I have. I'm not making a halakhic decision for you because it might be different because, you know, I'm in a Noahide situation. But that was how we ended up dealing with that.
Right. No, that's an absolute statement he was making.
No. I'm sorry. None of the stuff you were talking about, Doug, would actually have, like, you know, God's name, you know, like a four-letter name written in it or anything like that, right?
It would be English.
That's a good question.
But what would the difference be? What's the difference whether you write it in Hebrew or English? If it was written by a person who has the wrong concept of God, so it's not, It's not
right. Well, I just wonder if there's a difference between, say, you know, what someone might mean when they use the English word God, as opposed to, I don't know, I thought there was, I don't know where I read it exactly, but there's some, you know, like for blasphemy and those types of things, but that there's like certain names that you can't write and then erase and things like that, right?
But that would have to be this God's name.
Yeah.
And that's defined by the writer.
The English word God had this, what's that?
The writer would be defining it. What would be the difference whether the writer wrote, you know, his false notion of God in English or Hebrew? I don't know if the Hebrew letters themselves have any significance unless the, you know, it's written with the right understanding.
Seems like there's conflicting mitzvah to destroy Avodah Zarah and then not to destroy God's name, so how would you really handle that?
Right, but it's not God's name anymore if a person wrote it thinking the wrong idea of God. That's what Rabbi Chaya was saying. All right. Okay, so next week I have to let you know, I'm not sure there will be class next week. As of right now, I'm going to cancel. I have to be upstate next week. So unless you hear otherwise, we're going to pick up 2 weeks from today. But I'm pretty sure that I will have to be on the road by this time.
Okay.
So we'll pick up in 2 weeks.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Rabbi.
All right, everybody. But feel free to be in touch during the week, like always. You know, even though we just have a class once a week, any questions come up or so on, you know, be in touch.
All right. Have a good week and safe travels.
Okay. Take care, everybody.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.